This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to the Asian Cinema Film Club. This is episode 24 and I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones. Joining me as well, of course, is the Professor, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
The Professor says hello.
And tonight we're also joined by our very special guest from Trenko Dreams, Game Warp, and Movies and Tea. She's a lady of just many, many outlets for her talent. It is, of course, the one and only Miss Kim Lowe.
Hi.
And tonight we are going to be talking about The Bullet Vanishes. This is a mystery thriller from 2012 and is directed by Lo Chi Lung. I'm no doubt probably going to, you know, mess up some of these names as, well, always seems to be the case in the show. And tonight Kim's no doubt going to be correcting us on that one. But, you know, we'll apologize in advance that if any we screw up any of these. But, I mean, how have we all been since we obviously got together last? I mean, we're now on 24. 25 is going to be a very special show, which we're obviously going to be talking about at the end of this episode, as we've got something really great planned. I mean, what's obviously been sort of holding your interest since the last episode? I mean, Stephen, what have you been watching, if anything?
I haven't been watching anything Asian. I literally haven't seen a single Asian film since we last spoke, which is all a bit embarrassing when you think I'm meant to be the professor. But I have been obviously doing a lot of stuff on my other podcast with lots of other subtitled cinema, and I guess I've been getting a lot of that in the bag, so lots of things, but to be exposed later on.
Okay, because yes, you got your currently doing your world tour podcast, and was it Guerrilla Ramblings World Tour?
That's right.
Certainly, if you go on our Facebook page or Twitter, you can see that we post up the episodes there as well. So, and I mean, how's that going? I mean, what, has there been any highlights or anywhere you're planning on going next, or is that all
a big mystery? I'm just trying to think. So, at time recording, last week I put out, I really went abroad and did a couple of British films with Nell and I and Prevenge. Off to France next with a Luc Besson, and I'll also look at Amelie. So I've got a few more sort of individual countries to visit. And then I think I'm going to do some more genre themes. So I've got an episode planned on some extreme cinema. Hence why you might have seen I finally got round to watching Salo or 120 Days of Sodom, which I feel all kind of Zoe right now.
I know she's she has mentioned it on one or two occasions, much like a Serbian film, and I think maybe you need to obviously, you know, have a sit down and get Zoe's thoughts on that one, because I feel that you're going to be coming from it from very different places. And
I think you could be quite right about that. But yeah, so I think I'll do sort of like 12 episodes I'll have on different countries, and then I'll do some more sort of genre related stuff. And I'm sort of 3 episodes ahead of where I thought I would be, so that's quite cool.
That's exciting. Yeah, definitely. Kim, have you ever seen Salo, or is that a pleasure still to await yourself?
I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Keep it that way.
Some call it art, some call it smut. It depends on which side of the fence you happen to be coming from it. It's based on a classic erotic text, and it's an eye-opening experience, to say the least. I know that many people have said many different things. Some people really think it's fantastic, and other people say it's kind of boring. So, you know, something to look forward to there for you.
Okay.
But, I mean, have you been, what's your sort of movie watching been like? Have you seen anything interesting recently? Or?
Well, I mean, I've been doing the Valentine's Marathon, so I've been watching a lot of romance. I just watched the other Baleen Girl, which I did not enjoy. And then, I mean, there's things I discovered, like, in, you know, I was talking about it in a post before. I watched the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, which I like, you know, and, you know, the normal stuff, like, in regards to, like, Asian cinema, I've been watching a lot of TV, so, like, Asian TV.
Okay. And is there any particular sort of series that, I mean, we should be watching? Because it's, we're now in this real sort of boom for, like, Asian shows coming over and through, like, services such as, like, Netflix especially. And we've seen a couple come on Amazon Prime have started picking up these shows. And it's been really weird why they suddenly started picking them up. Because I thought it was just sort of like a little niche thing that Crunchyroll were running on their site. And now Netflix have really got in on the game. And, I mean, they've got in real hard. I mean, there's quite a big catalogue of shows that they're bringing across there. I don't know how current these shows are, but...
They're pretty current. I mean, to be fair, most of the shows that Netflix has is actually for free on YouTube. I just don't know if they're subbed in English yet, because they're kind of really behind. They kind of, like, release the episode, and then they sub it, like, the week after. So a lot of people complain about that, and then it's, like, really weird, because I know there's a show that just started that I'm watching right now, and I was reading the comments, and people were talking about, the subs is off sync with the actual conversation. So, I don't know. I don't watch it with subtitles.
They have a little... Yeah, I know you're obviously in the beneficial position of being able to obviously speak the native tongue, so it's unlike us ourselves who have to obviously pay attention to these things, but then again... I don't know, when it comes to subtitles, you kind of have a bit of leeway with it. I don't know what your thoughts are, Stephen, when it comes to subtitles, but whether it syncs up or not precisely with the dialogue, I never has been something that I sort of really concern myself with. What about yourself, Stephen?
I like it to have be at least sort of the person that's talking that their words are on the page. It kind of depends, though, doesn't it? Because if something's really quite sort of dialogue-heavy, you spend... quite a lot of time reading that and not looking what's actually going on with mouths and stuff anyway. It's that some of the sort of the lighter, frothier stuff, it becomes a bit more distracting when you're able to do both at the same time.
Yeah. I certainly find that having a dub track for anime really helps, because when you're faced with like 90 odd episodes to read in subtitles, it can be a bit of a slog. And if you've got a nice dub track, it means you can, you know, you can have it on in the background when you're, you know, cleaning, and it really helps. And that's only been the case for myself. I mean, I've just recently started climbing that anime Everest that is Dragon Ball Z, because every other sort of Asian media podcast out there, like Blake and the Lincoln Thieves or Anime Nostalgia, they constantly talk about Dragon Ball Z. And I never saw Dragon Ball Z as a kid. I don't know about yourself, Stephen, but for them, it was like this big childhood thing that it was always on, like, Toonami and stuff. And I was growing up in a household that only had four channels, and none of those were showing Dragon Ball. So it's now taken me at the old ripe old age of 36 to now finally try and get through all 262 odd episodes of this show, not including, like, the 37 movies that they created to fill in seasons and all the rest of that sort of fun stuff. And currently I'm 10 episodes in. And there's some really random stuff that I'm not sure if it goes over the heads of people as kids, but so far our hero Goku has been killed, so he's in the heaven dimension, and that's five episodes in. And then he got challenged to a game of Russian roulette, and there's a very sort of borderline racist looking character called Mr. Popo, who kind of reminds me of the Gollywog off the old marmalade jars, who's just basically like a black silhouette with these two white eyes and a turban. I'm not sure if that's actually racist or not, because he's obviously like a god, a deity sort of character. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting questions being raised, and it's a bit of a slog still ahead of me. So, but did any of you guys watch Dragon Ball Z? It's just something that never interested you?
Well, I think a bit like you, it's a bit overwhelming to even start. not just, you know, you could watch the anime, you could read the manga collections, there's films, there's even a couple of computer games, aren't there, out there. And I wouldn't even know where to start. And having 280 odd episodes facing me would be, that'd be a bridge too far for me, I'm afraid.
Well, I've got that, and I mean, I've still got One Piece, that's 400 episodes and counting. They're still making those. It's like one of those things. I feel that until I've seen it, it's going to be like one of those like gray areas in my sort of knowledge as an anime fan. And it's not bad. They're pretty short. They're only about 20 minutes a piece, so you can, once you get into the flow of the fact that you're going to be watching someone power up to do a move for like 3 or 4 episodes. So they really sort of pad out these episodes. So the fight scenes can take like 8 episodes to happen. It's not the quickest of anime pacing, but you know, there's some fun characters and interesting moments, as we've said already, and I'm kind of interested to see where it goes. And I'm still of the mind whether I'm going to do it all in one go or whether I'm just going to break it up and do it by season. I'm really not too sure at the moment yet. So you know, watch this space, and if you follow our Twitter and Facebook, I do post some random thoughts on things that obviously come up as they appear there. So I will hopefully have some form of write-up at some point of my experience as a noob watching Dragon Ball. But in terms of anime, I also wrapped up Goblin Slayer, which was thankfully only about 12 episodes long, a lot easier to get into, and there's a really nice dub out there as well for that, which makes all the difference. But if you like fantasy anime, Goblin Slayer is probably a really big recommend from the last anime season. Just a really great show, even though there is some questionable moments of sexual violence in there in that first episode, which has sort of got a lot of people riled up and just really casting a lot of judgment on the show even before they've got into the show. And I think if you're sort of a bit squeamish about that sort of thing, especially with anime, then you know, skip to episode 2 and just go from there and you should be fine. So but yeah, I mean, that's about it for, I mean, I think it's been a pretty quiet month all around. I keep saying I've got these things to watch, like I've got the Piper, I've got all these bits I keep saving on the box to watch. I just never seem to find the time to watch them, and it's just really kind of embarrassing. So I'm trying to stop watching so much dreck on TV and trying to watch more films at the moment, and trying to clear that off. So hopefully, you know, touch wood, I will have some more films to talk about on the next episode. Obviously tonight we are talking about The Bullet Vanishes. I mean, Kim, this was your recommendation. Okay, you recommended several films for us to discuss in this one, and this is the one we went with.
Yes.
What was it about The Bullet Vanishes that really sort of held your interest here?
It's just really up my alley. Like, I like, well, first and foremost, I'm a big fan of Nicolas Tse. So that was the...
Oh, that's why we're watching this.
So that was why. I think all the choices I gave you was with him in it. So, I don't remember, but it might have been. But, yeah, no, I really like this one. I picked this up because I wanted to watch, you know, his movies. There was a time I was catching up with his movies. And then this one was surprisingly good. Like, it was a lot better than I expected because it's kind of like, I really like that mystery thing, that kind of like, you know, investigating and kind of the humor of it. And everything just really works together, even though, like, as I watch it a second time now, I'm seeing all these, like, these kind of, like, parallels with a lot of, I guess, some Hollywood scenes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty good. Like, I think it's a really clever movie.
Okay. I mean, for those not obviously familiar with the film, as we said already, it's a Hong Kong mystery film. And very much in the vein of Sherlock Holmes, as we follow the detective an inspector called Song Dong-Lu, who's basically the Sherlock Holmes sort of character of the piece. He's got these very unique methods of solving crimes, and just his whole sort of approach to crime and criminology in particular is just very unique. And he's teamed up with Nicolas Tissé's character, Captain Guo Zhu, who's not only a detective but also a gunslinger as well. And they're basically sent in to investigate these mysterious shootings that are happening in a bullet factory, which the workers believe is relating to a curse of the Phantom Bullet. And it's basically these two go in and they're trying to find out why these bodies keep turning up. They've been clearly shot, but they can never find any bullets, and whether it is actually this mysterious phantom bullet that all the workers are claiming is responsible for these deaths. As I said, this is a real sort of fun little mystery romp. There's very much these veins of Sherlock Holmes to it, and in particular, I think if you watch it and you've seen the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes, you're probably going to draw a lot of comparisons there. But Stephen, I mean, is this the first time you watched yourself? Have you seen this one before?
Nah, so it was first time for me, which is surprising. I think I had a bit of confusion about which film we were actually watching, which is why I spoke to you last week about it. But it's really weird that I haven't seen it, because I'm a big fan of the director. In fact, he's one of the few directors I think I've seen just about every film he's ever made. Okay. I'm a big fan of Nicholas Tay. I'm a big fan of Sean Leung. I even like Yang Mi, who plays one of the main female characters. So I'm really surprised a film from 2012 I hadn't picked up before. And also, I like a detective drama as well. So it had all the sort of combinations and characters and actors and so on and so forth that I should have really loved this.
I'm sensing that you didn't, though.
I think it's what Kim alluded to, and that you also mentioned that it seems to draw on a lot of tropes, especially from sort of 2000s Hollywood films, like the Guy Ritchie Sherlock Holmes films, that I kind of already knew, you know, the detective who does things to himself to learn about the world. I mean, I'm sure to quite early on, Sean Lau's character hangs himself to work out what happened. And I'm sure I've seen that in another film before. They did the thing about, oh, is it an ice bullet? I've seen that on CSI, and I just felt a lot of these things weren't fresh and new to me. So even though I thought it was incredibly well acted and absolutely gorgeous to look at, I mean, it's in terms of sort of the sets and the characters. And of course, the other thing I love is 1930s China, Shanghai and places like that. I just love that whole look, sort of that westernized Asian look that's going on there. So I really feel all the components are in place for me to absolutely adore it. But actually, I thought the execution was a bit meh.
You see, I'm coming from this place, a complete opposite place, because I absolutely adored this. This is like, I've just really enjoyed this, the whole ride from start to finish. And yes, I obviously saw the comparisons to other properties. But at the same time, I find myself like constantly, when it comes to Asian cinema, that Asian cinema manages to do both like the Sherlock Holmes style mysteries, as we saw with things like Detective D, and Westerns just really well. And I find myself enjoying these Asian counterparts a lot more than the Western counterparts. Like, I can't stand normal Westerns. I find it the most boring genre. Yet, if you give me an Eastern Western, so something like The Good, the Bad, and the Weird, Takashi Miike's Western, was it Shizuki Western Django? Or perhaps to a lesser extent, Let the Bullets Fly, with Chow Yun-fat. I just really think they're fantastic films, just how they're paced, how they look, and just the style of them. And here with The Bullet Vanishes, we get this weird, almost like an amalgamation of the two styles, because obviously we have the gunslinger character here, played by Nicholas Tees, and at the same time, we've obviously got that, you know, that Detective D angle here, played by Liu Chang-wan. Oh, sorry, Liu Ching-wan? Am I saying the right, Kim?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Who
I just said, call him Sean. It's much easier.
Okay. Who's obviously, as you said, he's doing all these sort of like quirk things. The fact that he opens to him pretty much him hanging himself, and I thought, oh, is he like a suicidal detective? But no, he's just like got this whole method, and there's this fun little sequence where he's arguing with his assistant over the fact that his assistant was supposed to come and rescue him, but his sand timer got stuck. So he's just basically managed to self-hang himself. And just even like the simple scenes where he's there talking to this woman who murdered her husband from what we assume is an earlier case. And he visits her in prison. He's trying to understand why she killed her husband and how she did it. And just those scenes in particular, I thought were just, they just constantly find ways to add to these characters. Especially, and then we'd sort of combine it with this cast of real odious villainous types who make up like the owner and the goons of the bullet factory. And it just all keeps adding up. We have all these wonderful elements, as you said already. We've got like 1930s what's supposed to be it's not Shanghai, is
it's Tian Cheng.
Thank you. and the 1930s look, which, as you said already, Stuart, it's very sort of distinctive, and it just looks absolutely fantastic, especially here. The actual set design, the costume design, just everything across the board just looks so sumptuous and immersive. So yeah, it's a shame that you didn't like this more. I mean, just looking at these sort of characters, I mean, what did you obviously make of them? I mean, did you find too much of an odd couple pairing, or do you think that they sort of work well together? I'll pass it over to Kim first.
I think I get where Steven is coming from, but because I had like the same sort of feeling when I watched it, but I think I'm a little more forgiving because I've watched so much like Hong Kong stuff that, especially like when it comes to like TV series and stuff like that, Hong Kong has this like kind of concept of they always seem to be taking away like the best parts of Hollywood and then trying to inject it into their own films. Especially like in like genres where they're not, I guess like they're still learning or whatnot. And a lot of like, say, directors tend to like to do that a lot. And I don't know. I mean, I was okay with it. I think the oddest part of this was the romance. It didn't really make any sense, and it wasn't really, like, it felt like really just, you know, I like the Yang Mi character. She played, Little Lark or something like that, that's her name?
Yeah, that's yeah. Right.
And she, like, Yang Mi is very popular, like, put aside, like, her big controversy right now going on in China, but... Like, the deal is, like, Yang Mi, when, like, I haven't seen Yang Mi, like, I didn't realize it was Yang Mi, actually, in this movie, because I don't watch a lot of, like, I didn't know Chinese, China actresses, like, mainland China actors. But, yeah, no, I really liked her character, but it felt like the moment, like, it was, like, suddenly there was this, like, scene with her and Nicholas Tay, and then you were just kind of like, okay, so out of place. I don't know why.
No, I absolutely agree with you. In fact, I'm going to go a step further, and I think it's a bit cynical, really. And I think this is a bit of a problem with Hong Kong cinema, but much more recently, is unfortunately it needs the Chinese money.
Yeah.
So, you know, Nick Say, Sean Lau, Nick Say is a massive pan-Asian star. Sean Lau has got a host of leading roles, although he's probably not your archetypal handsome leading man, but they've brought in Yang Mi to, because I mean she's huge, she's like one of the four biggest actresses in mainland China. Yeah
currently, exactly, yeah. Like, right now she's huge, so that's why her divorce was such a big deal.
Indeed. And she's, you know, so she's almost in this film, and you see this a lot in sort of the last 10 years of Hong Kong cinema. There's always a Chinese woman, a mainland Chinese actress to bring in that money. And I found her character quite interesting, because it sort of starts off saying she's mystical, and then shows out that actually she's just a watcher of people and things like that. And then there's this weird sort of romance element, like you say, which just was from nowhere, and nothing's ever really done with her. And on the other hand, you have the other female character, Jiang Yan's character, which you talked about, Elwood, who's like this killer who's in prison, who has this relationship with Sean Lau that they don't ever really explore. And clearly, we're being set up for the sequel, which is exactly what has happened, I believe. I was much more interested in that than this strange little pretty people romance that was going on. And I think I was disappointed that the wrong notes maybe were sometimes explored. Yeah, and I almost felt almost like Nick Say was also in the film, just to make sure it got made. I didn't feel he was as connected to the main plot as he might ought to be. Although, obviously, as it turns out, he is.
yeah, I mean, you say that about Nick Say's character, but, and I mean, yes, I mean, we could obviously cut him out, but he's sort of like the muscle of the group. I mean, we've got this combination. We've got the brains and we've got the muscle, which is obviously Nick Say's character. And he has moments where he sort of gets a chance to sort of excel and show off his skills, such as we've got the scene where the goons are sent to go and rough Little Lark up, because she's obviously been tipping him off about what's been happening at the bullet factory. And they go to rough her up, and he gets this whole sort of elongated chase sequence culminating in I don't know how to describe it, it's sort of like a duel almost with one of these thugs. And how he has to like work out the range of his pistol and how far it can go, and just these real sort of crack shot elements that we get to see throughout the film. There's another really good shootout as well towards the end, and I mean, I just really like those moments that he gets to shine and show off his skills. Even though he constantly has to tell us that he's the fastest gunman. And so, like, do you need to open with that? Is this, like, your one claim to fame is that you just happen to be the fastest gunman in this town? I don't need to be told it constantly. You've already established this at the start of the film. I don't need it another 4 or 5 times as we go along. And as I said, I just never felt that any of these characters were sort of, like, there just to sort of pad things out to provide, you know, the pretty people romance, as you said, Stephen. I mean, I found it kind of touching, you know, the romance between Little Lark and Gazu. And Xatea's character, because, you know, it worked. They have good chemistry together, and it's like, well, why not? Even though I did think she was blind originally.
Yeah, that was the trick that she was playing, wasn't it? Yeah. But but did you not feel, I don't really know any of these people? That, you know, Nixay's character is absolutely defined by I'm the fastest gunslinger in town.
Yeah.
And that I know nothing about Little Lark other than that she fancies Gao. I know, you know, there's the other character, there's the local policeman who's sort of like a bit bumbly, that's learning from Sean Lau's character as well, who gets killed off 3/4 of the way through the film.
But
I was kind of interested in him, and there was this weird sort of funny little romance going on between him and the coroner.
And I
kind of into that, and I thought, oh, there's something there, but nothing was ever, I think it was ever finished or played out properly. And actually, it was probably hurt because there were so many characters in the film that we never really got to know any of them as well as I'd have liked.
I think that, you know, I feel that the characters were okay, but I think that the movie really tried to focus on, like, I felt like what they was trying to do was it was trying to create a lot of misdirection by giving these characters kind of like the sense of mystery. That's why they didn't like dive deeper into the characters, because it wasn't about them. It was just about like figuring out, like, you would learn about the abilities of all your characters as they're solving this mystery. I'm okay with that. You know, I feel that that's okay. And I really like, you know, there was like this bromance that kind of happened between like Nicholas Tse and Sean Lau. I thought that, you know, I felt like it really worked out. And as a misdirection, I was rewatching this and I completely, like, forgot the ending. Completely forgot about it. And I got, like, I was, like, surprised all over again. So, I don't know.
I mean, I can't knock it for the mystery. I mean, that side of it, I think, was actually done quite well. There's a cast of lots of people. Is it this person? Is it that person? Are you pretty sure they're in on it? But actually, it turns out they're not. And then people get killed off before the final act that you thought were going to be the big bad, you know. So bits of it, I think, are executed really well. So purely in that regard, in terms of a twisty-turny mystery sort of thing, I thought that was actually done rather well.
For myself, the mystery is so engrossing. I don't really need these characters to be fleshed out other than to know that they have possessed certain skills or they play particular roles within this mystery. And just how the mystery sort of develops, because, I mean, it breaks it down into all these sort of, like, you have this one big mystery of obviously how these people are getting shot, and then at the same time you've got all these smaller mysteries such as how the owner of the bullet factory is able to, you know, play this game of Russian roulette, which they call Fate of the Heavens. How he's able to play this game and not blow his own head off. That was a really fun sort of mystery, how they did it. I'm gonna try and avoid spoilers here. So if this film sounds of interest to you, that one, you still will be able to obviously enjoy the mystery, and, you know, how you can get a chopstick out of a glass bottle without touching the bottle or breaking the bottle. That's another fun mystery that I spent a large portion of the film trying to figure that out. I don't know about yourselves, whether you figured it out straight away, but just, I found myself, like, while this big mystery is being played on, I'm still trying to figure out how to get this bloody chopstick out of the bottle. Maybe that's just me. And the only thing, part that I didn't particularly like, is when we get to the end and we get this sort of final twist, and it just felt very tacked on. It's sort of like, we've solved the mystery, so why are we now, like, potentially killing off what could have been a really interesting sort of franchise by tacking on this sort of like epilogue to the story, which didn't need to be there. And that was the only time I found sort of issue. I mean, I loved the whole mystery. I loved how it was solved and the fact that it's not making these huge leaps in logic in order to make it work and to tie all the pieces together. Everything's very sort of logical and it's got plausibility to it, even though I'm not sure if certain aspects of it would work in real life or not. And certainly in case of the bullets, I have to wonder, I would need someone who knows physics and, you know, guns to tell me if how bullets work in this film, whether they would work the same in real life. I think there's probably a Wikipedia deep dive in that one. I mean, how do we feel about that last ending?
I don't have a problem with it. I thought it was really clever to do it that way. And it kind of like pieces together some of the conversation that they were having and some like odd lines, because, you know, Sean Lau's character was very like cryptic when he talked, and he would always like leave things out. And then like at the end, it was kind of like pulling everything together, and then it kind of made sense. Like maybe a part of it was kind of like a little bit, you know, a little bit, just a little bit stretched out and dragged on for too long. But I mean, I think that it was a good ending, especially because, you know, it kind of changes from like the normal sort of style of Hong Kong films that usually go, where it's always like, you know, it's kind of like a okay ending. It was kind of like, because it, you know, what it did was that it was like, it answered the question. I think it gave Sean Lau kind of like this thing at the beginning when he was talking with the woman in jail, and he was talking about, you know, they were saying, well, he's always looking at why do good people do bad things? What makes a good person go bad? And at the end, it's like he burns that paper, and it's kind of like just that one page he burns. And it seems like whatever went down at that final twist, like, really changed his perspective of kind of like, I guess, humanity and the good in people.
Steven, I mean, did you have any thoughts on the ending at all? I mean, did you think it worked, or do you think it's tacked on? Where's your sort of stance?
I didn't think it was tacked on. I think, you know, as Kim sort of rightly said, it was hinted at all the way through. There was weird shit going down with one of the characters we're not going to talk about, and some of the actions that they did, and sometimes when they turned up at places, that it all came good. And Sean Lau was clearly... his character clearly knew quite early on, because he said something which was a bit weird. So I knew how to get the chopstick out of the bottle, but it was the bit that was playing with me.
Well, good for you.
No, because again, I'm sure I've seen that in a film before. That was another example of something, I think, because I'm usually rubbish at that kind of thing. So how do I know that? But he said something about, oh, and there's a question about the three of us, and it sort of left out there. And so it kind of made sense to me at the end, and it makes sense that why certain members of this cast are in this film. And it is very hard not to spoil it, but it did have a bit of Detective D about it, where you have a very big Chinese star in a film that seemingly is playing the second character,
yeah,
and therefore actually there's more to their character than you would think. I think I've spoiled it by saying that, but you know what I mean.
I think we're safe. I mean, I did obviously think that Nicholas Tate's character, he was going to go out as like the heroic death when we have this huge explosion in the bullet factory, and it's shot so gratuitously slow mo, it would make the Wachowskis blush. I've never seen like a...
I think that bothered me more than anything else in the movie. I think that bothered me. That was like... it was, like, so exaggerated.
I can tell. Are they blowing them up for real? Because I know Hong Kong hasn't really got a good legacy of having health and safety when it comes to the safety performance. Or is this CGI? Or, I mean, I wasn't sure if it was shot for real or not. But it looked really cool. Apart from, like, the rippling jowls of Shaw Zhang. Now, Kim, I mean, you obviously were saying there's some controversy at the moment surrounding Yang Mi.
Well, it's not controversy. It's just like her divorce became a really big deal, and then it was like last year. It was like the end of 2018. They were like, I don't know, looking back at stuff or something, or I don't know, because I wasn't following it. Like, I don't follow actor and actress's divorces, you know? Like, it's not, yeah, it's not my focus. But it was, like, blowing up my, like, my Weibo account. So it was, like, everyday news alert. And it was just talking about that. And I was just like, okay, fine. Because I, like, because before Yang, like, before I knew Yang Mi, I knew her ex-husband, like, as in, like, Howick Lau is, like, a really popular Hong Kong star. Like, he was in a lot of TV series back then. And, like, I like his singing and stuff like that. So, it was really, like, I really liked that actor. I just didn't know that, well, celebrity, I guess. I just didn't know that, you know, they were married and then they were divorced by the time I got into Chinese, like, actual, like, last year when I got into, like, Chinese movies and TV series and stuff like that.
Yeah. I'm constantly surprised at the amount of scandal that's in the Hong Kong film industry, and just for doing the show. I mean, there's not perhaps not so much scandal surrounding the actors as there was when we looked at the twin effect on the last episode. But it's certainly with the female actors in this film, they all seem to have scandals of some sort. Because, I mean, we look at Yumiko Cheng, who played the coroner in this film. She's obviously started off as a singer and then moved into acting. But her career was sort of like, had numerous occasions of wardrobe malfunctions, which, I mean, am I right in saying that in sort of Hong Kong, it's sort of more frowned upon to have a wardrobe malfunction and just nudity in general?
Well, I mean, definitely in China, that's bad. Yeah, like, in mainland Kong, China, that's bad. In Hong Kong, I think, like, it would be frowned upon, but they're a little bit more open-minded.
They have the scandal rags, though, you know, that would make a big deal about it. But I think you can probably survive.
Yeah.
But in China proper, I mean, don't pay your taxes, you disappear for 4 months.
Yeah, exactly. And then you come back, and then you do this very rehearsed sort of letter to the public.
Yeah, very contrite, yeah. I mean, of course, you talk about scandal, and, you know, you talk about the female characters. Of course, we've got Nick Che here, who, boy toy of Fei Wong, and then married to Cecilia Cheung, and then left his wife to go back with Fei Wong again. I mean, that
was years, like, in between, right?
I think he was technically still married to Cecilia when he went back to Fei, but
I don't know. I think that the whole, like, Edison scandal did drive something between them.
Oh, in indeed.
Opinion. Yeah, indeed. I think that was, like, right after that scandal, I think things started going downhill. But it's just they stayed together. That's my analysis of it. Like, I think that Nicholas Tse has come a long way, though. I mean, I follow a lot of his stuff. And, like, I mean, he started out when he was 18. And it was kind of like this bad boy thing. And then, I mean, he obviously had his own scandal because he got, he ended up getting, like, X hundred days of community service. And then that caused a big scandal because there was this big corruption thing about him crashing his car when drunk driving, and then a bunch of stuff.
Multiple cars. It's not just the one. He had, like, a period of about 3-4 years where he seemed to be constantly in car accidents, so.
Yeah. I mean, he crashed his car, and it was, like, a DUI, and then what happened was that, apparently, what I understand is that they had a cop who agreed to, it was like someone who agreed to give him a pass, and then it was found out, and then he was like, and then it was like, he felt it was like, and then, like, he didn't even, like, he didn't think it was wrong or something, or think he could get away from it, I guess, and he didn't, and then he ended up getting community service, and then the cop got, like, I think 2 years or something like that, and then it was, like, this really big deal, because people were like, oh, wow, how come he has so little, and then the cop gets so much, and it's him who caused it's this big scandal thing that happened, but, I mean, when he came back out, he became, like, when he finished, like, the community service and all that stuff, it felt like he's really grown, and if you listen to, like, his business talk about, like, the company, his post-production company that he built and stuff like that, he's really grown as a person, and he's, like, he sounds like a really good employer as well, so, I don't know, I mean, I think that he's grown. Like, I've seen him since he started at 18, and now he's, like, you know, almost, he's, like, I think 38 or something now.
No, you're absolutely right, because, you know, stardom was thrust upon him at a very young age. And let's not forget, like all Hong Kong actors, you know, he's got multiple strings to his bow. I mean, now isn't he like a chef or something as well?
He has a Chinese mainland China show where he cooks, and then he goes, like, I saw, like, a snippet of it one day.
By all accounts, he's actually quite talented. I really like him. I mean, he's done some great films, but I think you're absolutely right. The point is that fame was thrust upon him before he was ready for it, and unlike maybe other young people who've done wrong in Hong Kong cinema and shown no contrition, I think he has, and he's grown, and he's probably better for it.
I think so. And I mean, like, I say that out of, like, the fact that I've admired a lot of his work, like, starting from when he was doing music to, like, movies, and he talks about, you know, when he does films and stuff, he actually, you know, he's very, like, Jackie Chan, where he, like, really wants to learn all these stunts and do it himself. So, like, I think he's very talented. He's gone a really long way. So, I mean, it's nice to see that, like, he's done a lot of really decent films on top of that.
Okay. I mean, obviously, since we got you on the show and as an admirer of his work, what sort of stands out in his filmography that you would recommend for people to obviously check out?
There's a lot, so give me a second while I go.
That's okay.
Go to
can I throw a couple in?
You can throw some in there, Stephen.
So, The Stool Pigeon.
Mm. Okay. Yes, that's a good one.
Bodyguards and Assassins.
Yes, also one I would suggest.
Yeah, Stool Pigeon especially, that's I think is that the sort of the second in three really fantastic films that Dante Lam did, along with The Beaststalker. Nick Chung, I think, said a lot of them as well. But Nick saying that. Bodyguard and Assassins is what I was going to... One of the films I think of pairing this up with. It's a bit of more of an ensemble piece, but Nick kind of holds it together. Yeah. What else?
I would suggest one of his earliest roles, Gen X Cops.
Mm-hmm.
That one's a good one. The Fireman one that came out in 2014, As the Light Goes Out, is pretty good too.
Is it Sean Lau's in that as well, isn't he? I'm pretty sure. Simon Yam.
Yeah.
And Sean Yu, and yeah, no, that's really good as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of a backdraft for Hong Kong.
Okay. I'm surprised none of you mentioned Dragon Tiger Gate. The Donnie Yen movie, which really sort of marked Yen coming to the prominence as sort of like the main martial artist of choice and sort of surpassing Jet Li, as he was sort of went from doing Dragon Tiger Gate and then went on to like the Ip Man films. So I really surprised that neither of you obviously mentioned that one, but yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would mention a lot more before that one, because I wasn't a big fan of it. Yeah, so I think that's why it kind of, like, slipped through for me, because if even before that, I would go for, like, New Police Story or Invisible Target or Beast Stalker or something like that before I would go to that.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, just you said already, Stephen, he's a man of many, many talents, and this always seems to be the way when we look at actors in Hong Kong, certainly like Hong Kong and Chinese cinema, you can't just be an actor, you have to have many strings to bow. And I think he may have one of the longest lists, because he's an actor, martial artist, singer, songwriter, entrepreneur, and chef. And as you said already, Kim, he's a TV chef and food critic as of 2014, even picking up the Friends of Michelin Award for his cooking, which is given to non-professional chefs. But I think that would have obviously changed if you said he's got a restaurant now. So,
and Kim obviously likes him because he's actually Canadian. But that's...
Has that anything to do with that?
But does he actually live over in Canada, or is he just carry a passport?
Nah. He lives in China.
Yeah, he was born in Hong Kong, but his nationality is Canadian.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not sure how that works.
Yeah, you can have that.
How does he? If he's born in China, how can he be his nationality be Canadian?
One it imagines. Works. Imagine it's works. One of his parents. So there is a sequel. I haven't seen the sequel. I'm interested enough to go and watch the sequel, because I think that concentrates more on the other crime and the lady escapes and
What's the sequel? I didn't know there was a sequel.
The Prisoner Vanishes.
The Prisoner Vanishes?
Yeah, The Prisoner Vanishes, because it's the direction they chose to take with these sequels. It's not been rated very highly from what I can see on Letterboxd. People don't seem to have liked it as much as this one.
Okay.
You can also find it under The Vanished Murderer.
Oh, yeah, The Vanished Murderer. Yeah, that was the one I found, yeah.
You can obviously find that out. It's, again, it's still directed by Lo Chi Lung,
mm-hmm.
who, I mean, would you say it's a director whose filmography is worth sort of working through, Stephen?
This is his best looking film by far.
Okay.
He hasn't made many, and he's only made about 8 or 9 films. But he did Double Tap, which is sort of a late Leslie Cheung police thriller, which is very entertaining. He did In the Senses, Leslie Cheung's last film, so that's a horror ghost story. He did Coma, which is Karina Lam and somebody else in a sort of a psychological thriller based on the urban legend of, you know, waking up in a bathtub and finding your kidney's been taken away. Very entertaining films. This feels, as in terms of the production quality, the set design, the costume, and even the music, this seems to be a step up. But I've never really been disappointed with one of his films. It's usually very entertaining.
Cool. Just obviously looking at the critical praise, Robert Abel of the Los Angeles Times gave a negative review, saying the film was visually stunning but emotionally empty, and it had no story but lots of action, which goes to prove that he knows jack shit about film criticism. But, you know, maybe he's got some riveting spreadsheets to show me as well. So, but further viewing, what do you pair with this film? I mean, I'm a little limited on what I would actually put with this. I mean, I think I mentioned both my films I would sort of recommend already, which would be like Detective D, Mystery of the Phantom Flame, or if you want sort of more the gunslinger element, then watch The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. But I mean, Stephen Kim, I mean, what would you sort of pair with this, if anything?
I only have one that I thought of, so it's the 1999 film Running Out of Time, also with Sean Lau, and it's with Andy Lau as well.
Cool.
Yeah.
So I've got four, but that's because I've gone a slightly different route. I think this is a bit of a stargazing film. I think there's you know, we've talked at length about Nick Zay. So if you're interested in him, I guess Kim and I have already listed a whole bunch of films. So I was going to go for Bodyguards and Assassins for that. Sean Lau is a fantastic actor. And he's got a huge back catalogue. But in a completely different genre, one of his earliest film performances is the romantic Sick Girl movie, C'est la vie, mon chéri, which I would highly recommend, but it's a completely different kind of thing. If you like the whole 1920s, 1930s look of this film, another one you could go for, this is a horror movie called The Matrimony, starring our favourite tax dodger, Fan Bing Bing, is a beautiful looking thing with the same sort of set dressing, but it's a totally different sort of film. And for detective movies, there's three of these films by Oxide Pangs, all starring Aaron Kwok, basically The Detective, The Detective 2, and The Conspirators, which is number 3. But the first one, which I think is also called C+ Detective.
Yeah.
It's a completely different sort of detective, but it's fantastic. I love all those films. It's a much more down on your luck, gritty, kind of thing. I think it's set in Thailand, actually. But yeah, I'd really recommend that as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you mentioned about Sean Lau. He has got an absolutely stonking back catalogue of both TV and film work then. Another one I would recommend, which you didn't mention already, and that would be Fairy Tale Killer, which is kind of like Seven, where this serial killer, he's going around and killing people off in various gruesome ways in using the theme of fairy tales to conform his murders. It gets a bit stupid at the end, but the journey there is fun, and it's got some interesting ideas. As well as featuring a rarity of obviously showing a child with autism in a which is something I've never seen in an Asian cinema film, so that was kind of interesting to see as well. But again, Sean Lau is absolutely fantastic here, playing another sort of gruff inspector drawn into a case that you get the feeling he'd rather not be involved in. So, but yeah, that's sort of my one other contribution to this. But thank you, obviously, Kim, for coming on and recommending The Bullet Vanishes for us this evening.
It's always a pleasure.
I liked it.
I'm glad you liked it.
I liked it. Sorry about Stephen and him not liking it.
I didn't not like it. I was just a bit meh about it. But there was plenty to talk about, and it's a stargazing cast, and it looks absolutely beautiful. So, believe you me, Kim, we've watched worse.
Coming up on the next episode, it is episode 25, and we're going to, as we've said on previous episodes, we're actually making a bit of a big deal every time we hit that 25 episode mark. So the first of our big selections we're going to be looking at for episode 25 will be, of course, arguably one of the most important films in Asian cinema of the sort of last recent 20 odd years, and that would be Battle Royale. We're going to be obviously discussing the absolute cult classic, looking at the inspiration, the source novel, the influence it really had on Asian cinema being imported to places such as the UK and the States, and how it really sort of sparked the boom and revival of interest within Asian cinema, which at that point was probably suffering from something of a lull, with only perhaps small areas of genre cinema and art house cinema really getting imported across. But the release of Battle Royale and alongside Audition of the Rink really sort of opened the floodgates for many new and exciting directors to come across, and we'll certainly be looking at that on the next episode. Also, keep an eye out, as we are going to be recording some bonus episodes. We are going to be releasing the first of our personal sort of picks. We've talked in the past of how we're going to be compiling a list of 50 films that we feel ourselves are essential. I'm going to be doing 25, Stephen's going to be doing 25, and the first of those lists will be appearing very shortly as a bonus episode, so make sure you keep your eye out for that. And if you haven't done already, you know, please leave us a rating or leave us some comments wherever you happen to be listening to us, be it Stitcher or Podomatic or iTunes. It really helps with the show getting out there and getting more people to see the show. And you can also interact with us both on Facebook or Twitter. You can also check out our blog, which is asiancinemafilmclub.wordpress.com. On there we've got the full archive of episodes as well. But until next time, again, thank you, Kim, for coming on, and thank you, of course, to my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
You're welcome, and thank you, Kim, as well.
And we will be back next time to talk about Battle Royale. Hey! Hey!
昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ月が砕けちっても星が燃えて落ちても踊り続けていたい夜なのさ胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える想いを狂わすのさ昨日の恋は忘れて昨日のあの子は忘れて踊り続けていたい夜なのさ